Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 41, section 6, which is old single column, page 461. All right, before we get started with calcium, the mystery of why there's a whole section on calcium, of all 100 elements, why calcium, I want to do a little follow-up on what we did last session in the previous section that will help set the contrast so there isn't any confusion with what we are going to engage in tonight. You may recall, what is that? That's fourth paragraph in section 5. They brought up that issue of how long it took a particle to go from the center of the sun all the way out to the surface and escape. And it said it requires more than 500,000 years. And we talked about that part, and how that relates to current challenges, the false initial assumptions of current stellar interior theory. And that's giving us a data point. But the next thing that they say, we didn't flesh out the curiosity of what it says next. Now, if you're aware of stellar astrophysics, you're expecting something that follows to be talking about a photon. But it says an X-ray stimulated electron. It requires more than 500,000 years for an X-ray stimulated electron to work its way from the very center of an average sun up to the solar surface. What do they mean by that? At first blush, you're thinking, well, okay, I know what an electron is. Apparently, they were talking about X-rays, and we talked about that recognition that they're trying to get us to appreciate that fundamentally a star is a sphere of motion. There's a system, a very complex system of motion that manifests as a sphere. And spherical domain encompasses lots of particles, which are themselves motion, but also waves in the force charge of space, all in a coupled system. And we were talking about how they're using the X-ray idea to really focus on a very energetic dynamics in the force charge that all these particles are coupled to. It's a very, very active environment. And so you say, okay, well, they must be talking about, an electron that's really being influenced by this high energy environment. But they're not. They're not literally talking about, that particle that we call an electron, with a charge of -1. Remember how I was pointing out how in that section they were trying to get us to recognize, certainly back at the beginning of the 20th century, but still today, that with a photon you have a literal particle. It's not just a measure, a quantum, of energy, like current scientists think, a packet of energy that they might call particle-like. Okay? It's nothing, it is literally a particle. There's a collection of 100 ultimatons. Okay? And then there's energy, electronic level energy, added upon that foundation of 100 ultimatons. Every particle is a collection of 100 ultimatons with some degree, small or quite large, of energy, electronic level energy, added upon that base, augmenting, you know, the totality of the energy phenomenon. They, you know, you just heard me use the expression from the Revelation, electronic level. Or you'll hear me talk, you know, refer to sub-electronic level. Notice, you know, that what the word is, sub-electronic. Okay? You know, and if you go to the next, you know, when we get to the next paper, we'll see it directly. You know, when they talk about that electronic level, you know, they don't say that's electrons. They say that's those most fundamental particles that you've begun to discover, things like a proton, you know, or, you know, we know about neutrinos very definitively now, an electron, also a photon as a particle. You know, the electronic level is, like I said, the base for that is that collection of 100 ultimatons, and then energy added upon that is electronic level energy. It's energy built upon that electron-like foundation. You know, we knew about the electron, so they could point to that. You know, and we definitely thought of that as a little billiard ball particle. Okay? And like I said, we still, in many ways, don't grant the photon as definitive a particle nature. I mean, they'll just treat it in mathematical terms, call it a packet of energy, a quantum of energy, call it a quanta, or at best, like I said, particle-like. Okay. See, what they're talking about there is literally not a particle that has a charge. You're not, a particle with a charge is not drifting out. You know, it's that neutral photon, very energized. You know, it's in equilibrium with this very active environment. It's a very high energy photon, but it's a particle that's drifting out of there. Okay. So, you know, that you have to, you know, you have to come to recognize that logically that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to do their best. You know, they can't literally spell those, you know, those issues out. We, you know, because that would be a violation of their mandate. But they're pointing as definitively as they can, you know. And like I said, everything within the Revelation allows you to eventually recognize, wait a minute, they're using electron, and, you know, in a little more generalized sense, and they're talking about electronic level. They're not just talking about electrons. Okay? A proton is an example, right? So in this instance, you have to eventually recognize that that's what that's talking about. And then it's, you know, and that's why, oh yeah, they're talking about what we talk about, you know, one of those packets of energy that we call a photon drifting out. And like I said, taking perhaps considerably less time than they're saying there to get out. Now I'm stressing this because we go to the next section, and they're going to talk about electrons again. Okay, now they're literally talking about what we call an electron, that little thing that we think of as some kind of a little billiard ball. Even if we kind of magically think of it as a billiard ball with zero radius, but nonetheless we think of it as a little particle, a little thingy of some sort, as opposed to some sort of tenuous energy packet or something, you know, at least initially. So you have to be on your toes with the Revelation. You have to, you have to be in the proper mode so that you appreciate what domain of the physical world they're talking about, and then you notice how they're talking about it. You know, and you know, in that proper framework, then you can properly interpret what they're saying. You know, it's very important to have a sense of the truth of what's going on in the passage you're reading before you try to engage the facts even the facts that are as immediate as the particular word that's on the page. You know, you've got to figure out if they're doing a little suggesting. Sometimes they'll actually say they're suggesting, not always. Or are they wanting you to start in a kind of right where you are in a very simple sense? We'll get to this next time after the calcium section here. We start to get into the whole modes of energy generation in the center of a star. And we'll see the classic pattern in the book where they first give you a revelatory picture that if you're thinking very precisely about, you'll be wondering, what are they talking about? This doesn't sound anything like what we currently think. Then that'll be followed by a contrast. This is the basic pattern they do. Go, here's what it really is. And then after that, they say, here's how you currently think about it. Reflect on the contrast. Reflect from where you are. See if you can understand how the truth flows from where it has its beginnings, and faintly where you are, towards where we suggested you want to go. But we may have very definitive limits on how precise we can be about what we say. So you need to think really carefully and subtly, and don't try to clear your head of your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices about this issue. You know, so then when we talk about protons and neutrons and the nucleus, say, you don't think we're telling you that's now an absolute fact. You know, you have to notice if that's in this fundamental pairing where here's how you're supposed to think about it, here's how you're thinking about it right now with those billiard balls, those protons and neutrons. Can you begin to make the transition? Can you see the truth that flows through your confused factual rationalization? Right, so, but if you just, if you just gloss over, it's like, I don't understand this, the revelatory part. Oh, wait a minute, I recognize the word neutron. And you latch onto that. Okay, then you're definitely going to get the more distortion of meaning, not the less distortion of meaning that they warned you about at the beginning of the foreword. All right, so.
I'm totally confused.
Yes. Aren't we all?
Okay. Yeah. You sound like you're not, but okay. If you're confused, then I'm confused. An X-ray stimulated electron,
right.
Is that versus a non-X-ray stimulated electron? That also exists inside the
cell? No, what they're talking about, right now, if you interpreted the word photon to be literally a particle rather than the way scientists use that word, but if you use that word to indicate a particle, then you would say, an X-ray photon. Okay?
X-ray photon?
Yeah. Right? We're talking about a particle it's fundamentally a collection of 100 ultrons. What makes it a photon above just that base? An electronic level motionless collection of 100 ultramatons. There's motion subelectronic, but no electronic level motion. You start that base. The littlest things that you can add are what augment that base to make it a photon particle, an electron, or a neutrino. There's just tiny little measures of additional motion that you add upon that makes it one of those. And basically the difference between an electron and a photon is an electron, or its antiparticle, a positron, are a uniform rotational motion that's added to that. It's going consistently in one sense, or its anti-sense if it's the antiparticle. A photon is basically the same idea, only it's oscillating instead of consistently, uniformly going in one direction. It goes one direction and then back the other direction. So it's kind of almost electron, oh no. Almost positron, oh no. Almost electron, oh no.
Made up of 100 Daltons.
Okay, but made up of 100 Daltons that has that additional oscillatory motion added to it. And that oscillatory motion is coupled to the force charge, makes waves in the force charge. You know, we measure those waves. And we ignore the fact that if there's waves in the force charge, there must be something that made those waves. We don't demand a logical picture anymore. We just describe the waves mathematically, and then we're satisfied without saying, well, if there's waves, there's a wave generator somewhere, isn't there? No, we can just magically believe that waves, you know, are just there. You know, like you could be standing on the shore of a lake, and all of a sudden this water is flapping at your feet, and you go, well, I'm sure a boat didn't go by. I'm sure, you know, that, you know, chain of wakes just generated itself out there in the lake, and now they're lapping at my feet. If you see those waves lapping, even if you didn't hear the boat go by, you know that a boat went by out there somewhere and made some waves coming across the lake surface. We don't demand that sort of logical picture anymore. And the relevators, they're trying to get you towards that. It's like, if I say electron, you're going to be thinking particle. Now, hold on to that, you know, because X-ray stimulated electron doesn't, you know, where you're literally thinking the charged electron, that's nonsensical. That doesn't mean anything. So what are we trying to get you to recognize? Something that's stimulated in an oscillatory fashion. See, an X-ray stimulated, it means that collection of 100 ultrasounds will be stimulated in an oscillatory fashion, not in a uniform, one-directional fashion like a stable electron.
Hence light.
Yeah, yeah. And so, but, you can also have waves in the force charge without a particle going along with it. I can take a wire and make a current go back and forth in it, and I make radio waves. Those are waves in the force charge that go out from that wire, that antenna. But you don't literally have a particle going with that. I mean, right now, they have all sorts of weird thoughts. Like, if you have a kilometer wavelength radio wave, they're literally thinking there's a photon, quote unquote, that's a kilometer in size. Collections of 100 ultrasounds are not megameter, kilometer, meter. They're very, very, very tiny. Okay. So it's one thing to actually have a photon particle and the waves associated with it. It's another thing to have particles that are located someplace and are generating waves, and the waves go out, but there's not a particle that's there with them.
Yeah. I don't want to belabor this, but I happen to be reading about this and what I do for a living, and a lot of the scientists are now talking about electrons being actual clouds, not really billiard balls anymore.
Well, we're going to get to that here in this next section, right? This whole issue of electrons are these little point-like particles in physics right now, except when that doesn't get you the correct answer. Okay, and then you assume they're a cloud, an amorphous cloud of influence. Yep.
Or wave.
Right, but then there's the whole issue of thinking of it as a quote-unquote wavicle, a wave and a particle at the same time, which is, again, silly. Right. Okay. But that's okay. So that's when we're about to read about electrons in an atom. The outer electrons in the atom. Like we said earlier. I mean, you can treat those to a high degree of accuracy like little billiard balls that are in orbit about a central influence. And we're definitely talking about literally an electron. But as Marge just said there, don't forget that if you zero in on the details, you discover that even those outer electrons don't act as if they're nothing but a little billiard ball going around in a vacuum in an empty space. They have an influence that's spread around over the whole atom, all around the whole atom, But that's not the electron that gets smeared out. It's coupled to the force charge. There's waves, a pattern of standing waves that are set up around that. If they weren't being constantly regenerated, would dissipate from that location. But as we're about to read, they don't get a chance. That electron is very present there and is keeping that system of waves there very definitively, without any sign of, varying in amplitude or anything, or in influence, as if there is this rock solid distribution of influence that you experience if you try to engage that atom in any way. Okay, all right, so now calcium.
Chris?
Yes, question? Yeah.
Roger's got some stuff in here. The great energy of velocity required to escape the gravity clutch of the sun is sufficient to ensure that the sunbeam will travel on with unabated velocity until it encounters considerable masses of matter, whereupon it quickly transformed into heat with the liberation of other energies.
Right.
Question.
Mm-hmm.
Does the electron react the same when it encounters a person on the space station as it does when it encounters a person on the planet after it has passed through our atmosphere?
Right, see, and another, he was reading the end of that next paragraph from what I was just reading there in section 5. See, and one of the ways that you understand, subsequently, they're not literally talking about an electron. Like, the sun does put out literally put out electrons that, are coming off the corona, and head towards the Earth and hits the Earth's magnetic field and spiral on the magnetic field lines and make aurora and all that. Okay, there are literally electrons too. But when you're, when you go on reading, and you talk about whereupon it is quickly transformed into heat, okay, it's like, well, wait a minute. I think they're talking about a photon there, aren't they? You need to think carefully, logically about what they're saying and just appreciate it. They said it that way, electron, to try to get me to stop being so abstract and just thinking about things mathematically. No, think about them literally, and if you can't understand it logically, literally, then try again. Don't be satisfied with just something that gets you the answer. That whole orbital model, where you have quote-unquote electrons smeared out over space, will get you the answers to, what's the wavelength of this transition from this excited state to this, lower state or whatever in an atom. It'll get you the answer. You might have to get out a supercomputer to get all the decimal places, but it'll get you the answer. Okay. But that doesn't mean that's literally the case, that there is no definitive reality to reality. To believe that reality isn't real, that it's just an abstract wave function space, there aren't literally things, that's a pretty radical step to take, and that's the radical step that humans began to take 100 years ago. And we need to take a deep breath and go back and re-understand these things where there's literally things, not just mathematics. Okay, so now, calcium, the wanderer of space here. Let me just say up front that here again, to fully appreciate what they're about to say, you have to have some knowledge of how astronomers were talking about stars and space, matter and space, back at the beginning of the 20th century, especially, say, in the 20s and into the 30s. Calcium was a very big deal in the common parlance amongst the astronomers back then. And a modern astronomer, you know, who knows his history, and they usually do, astronomers are usually pretty good about having a good sense of their history of their field. And they read this, they're going, okay, whoever wrote this must have written it back in the 20s, you know, or best the early 30s. And they're just given that old shtick that we now have matured out of. You know, if you don't know about that, you don't know that you could easily misinterpret this. You know, that you could get off on a false tangent with this, just like you can with the 48 units of pattern control. You know, where you think that's that old false idea that there were 48 chromosomes. Like, no, this is another example. They're not validating those outdated ways of thinking about this. They're trying to show you that your initial impressions, which you've now convinced yourself were misleading. Yes, your initial impressions didn't give you all the facts, but your initial impression had a very important thread of truth that you've lost. And we're going to devote a whole section to the Urantia book to this fact to help you, to challenge you, to go back and not lose that thread of truth that was potentially budding there back 100 years ago. There's something that you stumbled upon there that was very significant. And I say stumbled upon, but the more you reflect upon what was being discovered in science, in all fields of science, you know, especially the last half of the 19th century and then into the first decades of the 20th century, the more you reflect on that and the more you reflect on what the revelators needed in order to be able to have anything upon which to base a fifth epochal revelation, the chicken and the egg question starts to come definitively into play. Just how coincidental were some of these discoveries? It's very fascinating. Some of the things that were discovered, and then in many ways, not much has been discovered since. You know, it could be that, you know, logical that just the low-hanging fruit, which you need to base a revelation on, you know, you're going to discover that first, so there's nothing mysterious about it. But you can kind of wonder, you know, if there might not have been some supremacy, at least in play, where, you know, you don't have to go to as far as thinking that, you know, there's some celestial whispering in someone's ear, take over there! You know, or something like that, turn the dial to 5. You know, it may not have to be that interventionary, okay, but it is it's at least a delightful bit of supremacy that the minimum that that they needed was acquired. And then it's just up to us to hold on to what we had acquired there in our initial ignorance, hold on to it firmly. Let go of the confusion that we've built upon that. Go back and build a truer picture anew.
So are you saying that they actually projected that we were going to be going off on a tangent in this, you know, this book?
That's why the book is in my lap. If we weren't going to go off on a tangent, you wouldn't need an epical revelation to help us with our tangent. Right? Now, if we weren't going off on a tangent, would Machaventa had showed up 4,000 years ago?
You know, I'm a scientific
thing. Yeah. I mean, they know very well where we were going. Even some humans back at the beginning of the 20th century knew very well where we were going and knew it was not looking positive. So if a handful of humans could figure it out, they're not obviously lauded in modern times here, so-called modern times, but they were there and they were speaking. I mean, if obviously if humans could figure it out, could see the writing on the wall, the celestials knew very well what kind of confusion we were going to be drifting into, you know, and what kind of help we were going to need. All right, so let's... did you have another question, Marge?
Yeah, the last paragraph starts out, the action of certain secondary and other undiscovered energies present in the space regions. I'm wondering if that's sort of like a foreshadowing or sort of like a hint that the next section six, calcium, might be one of the secondary influences. It's just a thought. We don't have to.
you're talking about where in section five there?
The last paragraph, it talks about the action of secondary, certain secondary.
Oh.
And other.
Yeah, we talked about that last time.
Okay,
those details. I went into that last time, yeah. Right. No, initially, what's going on in the calcium one is kind of a lot more tangible from a current scientific perspective. But gentle twists thrown in so that you don't dismiss it as being as prosaic as you initially, or as prosaic as you now think. Go back with a bit of the childlike wonder that you had when you first made these discoveries back at the beginning of the 20th century, and hold on to that childlike wonder. Enter the kingdom as a little child again. You know, and don't, you know, think you're so sophisticated. Oh, okay, so much for that. Let's just throw that out, and there's nothing significant here. Okay, let's read a little bit here.
Section six, calcium, the wonder of space. In deciphering spectral phenomena, it should be remembered that space is not empty, that light in traversing space is sometimes slightly modified by the various forms of energy and matter which circulate in all organized space. Some of the lines indicating unknown matter which appear in the spectra of your sun are due to modifications of well-known elements which are floating throughout space in shattered form, the atomic casualties of the fierce encounters of the solar elemental battles. Space is pervaded by these wandering derelicts, especially sodium and calcium.
Okay, now, from a scientific perspective, that paragraph seems to be fairly straightforward, but it's actually filled with all sorts of very subtle things that if you don't appreciate, if you go past the first paragraph, you'll just get so confused and it'll seem so not possibly valid that you're going to decide, well, there's just nothing but old garbage here. Let's just move on to the next section. You've got to pay really close attention to all the things that they're talking about. And again, you can't appreciate it unless you know all the things that were swirling back 100 years ago or more about these issues. Okay, so let's... Let's start with the very end there, where they say, especially sodium and calcium. Okay, so, and then, you know, earlier they were talking about how there's a bunch of stuff in space. Okay, right at the beginning of the 20th century, they were studying binary stars. Stars that you can tell are binary because they're eclipsing. I mean, that one of them goes in front of the other while you're observing it, and so the light dims and comes back up. You have this periodic variation in the light, and you can study the dynamics of these, figure out their masses. And so obviously, if you're looking at the light coming from a star that's moving like that, these two stars that are going around in circles around a center of gravity, that light is Doppler shifted. As the star is moving away or coming towards you, it's red shifted or blue shifted as it's going around. And so you can see the spectral lines move towards the red, towards the blue. So they're carefully studying these, and they notice there's this pair of spectral lines in the spectrum of the star they're studying that don't move, like all the other ones in the spectrum. And they're trying, what's going on here? And they notice they're really sharp, too, very narrow. Took a little bit of thinking, and then, oh, you know what's going on here. The space between that star I'm observing and me is not empty. There's material between us. Yeah, and the light is coming from the star, and some of it is being absorbed by that material, by that gas that's in the space between, and hence, you know, not as much as getting to me. Those two, you know, thin little spectral lines, absorption lines in the star spectrum, were the two classic lines of calcium, called the calcium H and K lines. There's an initial set of mysterious lines that were observed in the sun that were labeled A, B, C, D, E, F, yeah. This is the H and the K ones that are caused by calcium. And so they made this huge definitive discovery. People had wondered if maybe there might be material between the stars, but this was definite proof. There's definitely material between the stars, and it looks like it's calcium. And so you got the idea of calcium clouds, you know, between the stars, as they were called. All right, so there was this very definitive fixation on calcium back then. Like I said, and so, you know, you're going, well, some old person wrote this, and sure, they're fixated on calcium. Everyone was fixated on calcium back then. You could call that age of astronomy the calcium age. You know, they were so fixated on calcium, okay, in all their observations. And then very shortly after that, again, initially, this is looking towards Orion, they found another really close pair of spectral lines, a classic pair of lines. They're called the K lines of sodium. They're yellow. That's why a sodium vapor light is yellow, you know, the sodium vapor street lights. And that's because the primary emission is in that K line. It's in the yellow part of the spectrum. The H and Ks of calcium are way at the very far violet end of the visible spectrum, almost to the almost into the near ultraviolet. And so sodium was added to the fascination as well. But definitely calcium was the biggie, you know, and you, for no other reason, it was first. And so it kind of, you know, it's like with everyone's favorite science fiction movie. Well, you know, the first biggie, you know, ends up being the one everyone favors. You know, why humans are about this. The first thing that you find, you know, ends up being lauded above subsequent things. But nonetheless, they discovered that there was this interstellar sodium and calcium. Okay, so you're reading that and thinking, okay, yeah, they're talking about that. Now, what else is going on in there? Okay, so in deciphering spectral phenomena, see, like I was talking about, the scientists were trying to decipher that spectral phenomena. It should be remembered that space is not empty, right? And they figured that out beginning of the 20th century, that light in traversing space is sometimes slightly modified. You know, like a little bit of energy will be taken out of a certain spectrum because it's absorbed by intervening gas. And that's a modification. But look at the little twist they throw in there. Sometimes slightly modified by various forms of energy and matter. Okay. You know, scientists are just thinking about matter, gas, atoms. Okay. There's going to be a whole complexity of energy phenomena, too, that we haven't even begun to appreciate that will affect this. You know, and so they're tossing that in as a little reminder that you've got huge undiscovered things, you know, in that area. Especially you start trying to understand light coming from galaxies way out in the outer space levels and stuff. you don't know about all these complex energy issues, I mean, even things like, you know, the gaps between the levels and the modification, you know, of the background that's there and all these background issues, you're going to not understand everything. Anyway, so they just throw that in passing. There's energy and matter which circulate in all organized space. Well, you might notice that they toss the adjective in there too, just to remind you that some of that energy and matter is not just some random thing, but has beings that are controlling it. And so the patterns that the beings impose upon that energy, you know, is going to get imposed upon this modification. You know, so if you're talking about stuff that's within the super universe, there could be even, you know, a lot of personality imprints upon this modification. Okay? All right, so all those little things, you know, so just the first sentence, you know, is definitively reminding you, we're not reading some old early 20th century plagiarizer writing here, right? It's a revelator who's doing their best to get you to think a little bit more deeply about reality. Some of the lines indicating unknown matter, which appear in the spectra of your sun. Okay, let's just start with that part. Okay, one of the things that is still going on, okay, but it was definitely really going on with lots of giant question marks way back, you know, in those days, early days. You know, we started to, you know, turn, you know, we developed spectrographs, and we started turning them, you know, turning these spectrographs on every object in space that we could point it at. It's like, what does this one look like? What does this one look like? They quickly started to notice that they were seeing spectral lines that they couldn't match up with any of the spectral lines of elements, you know, that we measure in the laboratory. Lots and lots and lots of spectral lines that just didn't seem to match anything. Especially when they started looking at the light coming from nebulae, you know, in space, like the Orion Nebula, say. There's all these spectral lines that don't match anything. And they, well, you know, we must have just discovered whole new atoms that, you know, don't even exist on this planet. And even when they, back in the middle of the 19th century, when they were first studying the sun carefully, they noticed these very definitive spectral lines in the spectrum of the sun that didn't match anything in the laboratory. They weren't weak lines either, you know, so that it might be some sort of strange, subtle phenomenon. These were strong lines, and they didn't match anything. I mean, that's how they first discovered the existence of helium. You know, is seeing helium's spectral lines in the spectrum of the sun. You know, and it wasn't until, you know, around you know, the end of the 19th century that they actually, literally on Earth, found the first helium atoms, you know, and measured its spectrum, and sure enough, yep, that's what that unknown element is in the sun. It's helium. Yeah, it's, you know, and then they tried breathing it and had all kinds of fun with it. Yes, putting it in balloons and right. So I mean, there's an example, you know, of, you know, when talking about unknown matter. I mean, helium is a, you know, is a very obvious historical example of that. But there's all of these other spectral lines in the sun and out in space as well. That they were trying to figure out what was going on. And they, you know, they finally discovered that their spectral lines of, you know, atoms we know, like oxygen, say, that aren't emitted normally in environmental conditions on the Earth. I mean, the main issue is the density is too high. You can get an atom to emit this frequency of light, but in order to get it to do it, you can't have another atom bonk into it and de-excite it. It needs to de-excite on its own, so there can't be any collisions with other atoms. Well, that's pretty tricky. It's pretty hard to get an atom in front of me here to not be hit by another atom. There's a lot of atoms in front of me. But you go into very, very rarefied situations, you know, maybe where there's only a few atoms, per cubic inch, and it could be a very long time before two of them happen to bonk into each other. And they'll sit there a long time. So if they're excited, so they began to discover that a lot of this unknown matter was actually matter we knew. It's just it was emitting light that we hadn't ever seen that atom emit before. Okay, so that's what's going on there. Those sorts of lines are called forbidden lines because they're forbidden under normal circumstances. Yep, did you have something?
Yeah, when you say that it was undiscovered, but it was actually known about, just to make the connection to something, helium, is that accurate?
Wait, I'm not following you there. That it was.
Okay, you just said that the unknown element part of that explanation.
Helium.
There was, yeah, helium.
Right.
And you said that it's not that we didn't know about it. You said it's just that we didn't realize that was the thing that was...
No. I mean, we literally didn't know. I mean, we didn't know of the existence of any of the noble gases until the very end of the 19th century because they're inert.
Oh, okay.
They're not chemically active. So helium, neon, argon, krypton...
Wait, the end of the 20th century?
No, the end of the 19th century.
Okay.
Right? Late, 1890s, right? End of the 19th century.
So we knew about them.
We did not have. I mean, if you look at a periodic table, from the 1800s, you won't see any of the noble gases in it because no one knew these things existed. No one knew of helium. No one knew of neon. Okay, because they didn't interact chemically, so no one had stumbled upon them. But we all right there at the very end of the 19th century, we isolated these things for the first time, it's the same time we finally literally isolated a helium, some helium on the planet here, and we did the other noble gases too. But in the case of helium, see, we actually had detected it in the sun several decades before, but didn't know it because, it was just unknown spectral lines. We didn't know what the heck they were from. Some mysterious element. But then you've actually found some helium and measured it, and it's like, ta-da! That's what that is in the sun. It's helium. So that's... like I was just saying there, they're called forbidden lines. Because they don't occur naturally under normal circumstances, even in a really hard vacuum in the laboratory. I mean, you can't get a vessel evacuated enough to get the collisions down low enough. I mean, it's very, very difficult artificially to get it that tenuous that you can get these and measure these. So it's not surprising that way back then we didn't we didn't know what these things were coming from. All right, now. So, that, like I said, basically, over the last 100 years, we think we've sorted that issue out. And even if we haven't figured out exactly what this particular spectral line is, there's a lot of spectral lines, and it's like, well, it's probably one of the gazillions from iron or something, we'll figure it out one of these days, which exactly spectral transition it is, but we believe that we know what's going on there. Okay, so you're going, well, okay, so why are they telling me this? Well, in that context, they're reminding you that some of the lines indicating unknown matter which appear in the spectra of your sun are due to modifications of well-known elements which are floating throughout space in shattered form. Okay, so you start modification of well-known elements and going, oh, yeah, like, I guess they mean ionized. Because, for instance, that calcium, those calcium lines we were talking about, that's singly ionized calcium that is giving rise to that, not neutral calcium. It's like, oh, they must be talking about that, and you keep reading, which are floating throughout space in shattered form. Well, that's kind of a weird shattered form. Does that mean ionized? Is that what I mean by that? Okay. We'll see here in a little bit, and plus it's very definitive in the next paper. Shattered and ionized are not equivalent. What the revelators are trying to do is to get us to appreciate that there's two different ways that you could be observing a calcium atom, for instance, that is missing one of its electrons. It could be in that state because it's ionized, or it could be in that state because it's shattered. The difference is, the revelators say you need to use the word ionized more precisely. Don't use it so loosely like you do. Separate shattered from ionized. See, so like what I just said, it isn't technically ionized calcium. It's shattered calcium. But current ones would call it ionized. Current scientists would call it ionized. If you have a neutral gas and you ionize it, you've separated some of the electrons from their immediate association with the rest of the atom. But the electron is still there in the vicinity. You know, what do scientists call that state of matter where in the net it's neutral, but if you zero in, you know, not every particle is neutral. Some are positive and some are negative. Some are electrons and some are the positive ions that were formed when you ionized it, the atom. You know, they call it a plasma. Okay. If it's a plasma, okay, then the revelators are saying, okay, use the word ionized for that. But there's another way. You could have a calcium atom that's out and about, wandering in space, as they're saying here, that doesn't have that electron that was separated from it still in the vicinity. The atom has been shattered, not just temporarily separated. It's been shattered, and it's off and about in broken form. You know, there's not the other electron trying to catch up, tagging along behind or something as it's wandering through space. It's just out there, broken, shattered. Okay. That's something that's not appreciated. Every time we see a quote-unquote ionized atom, we think of it as being in a plasma in space. And they're saying, well, yeah, it might be. But it also might not be an ionized technically. It might be a shattered atom. And this shattering could be very definitive. You know, you notice how they call them derelicts? Okay. Very strong word. Why derelict? Okay. Because while that, for instance, the calcium atom, while that calcium atom is down in the star, I mean, it may be initially ionized, but then that electron gets destroyed. Unraveled. So all the king's horses and all the king's men can't put it back together again. There's no electron to bring back in with it. See? So it's one thing for it to be separated, you know, within the circle of my fingers. It's another thing for the two parts to not be there anymore. One of the parts is gone. Okay? That's, you know, the very definitive way that they want you to understand the process of shattering and then shattered atoms being out there in space. Okay? Most likely, that electron has been unraveled, something that current science has no concept of. Okay? Unraveling an electron into automatons. Right?
Yeah.
Yep.
How does that compare to the theory with the free radicals, where a molecule will lose its electron and, you know, it causes damage in the body or whatever?
Right. I mean, I don't want to get too much. I mean, we'll get into that we'll get into that specifically when we get to paper 42 and they talk about ionized matter. Okay.
Because it can go and pick up electrons, other electrons.
Right. You can have various ways for material to get ionized. For instance, Have you ever poured salt into water? Yeah. That ionizes that salt. Okay, you have radicals in solution now. Okay, free in solution. Right, so we'll get into some of those details when we get more into the physics in the next paper. But see, what they're trying to say is, yeah, there's all these different things that you could properly call ionized, things like ionic solutions and whatnot. But you need another category of matter, shattered atoms, not just ionized atoms. Not just where they're separated from their electrons, but where the electron has gone bye-bye in one way or another. Okay? And now it's wandering derelict. Yep.
So a shattered atom, the electron is always destroyed? I mean, so if the electron is separated from it, there must be some critical distance where it can still be ionized or where it's separated far enough that it's not coming back.
Well, I mean, usually see when you're talking about plasma, you're talking about zillions and zillions of atoms and electrons all in a region, okay? And electrons have been stripped off, but they're in the mix flying around, in the same space that all of the positive ions are flying around. It can pick up any electron and re-neutralize. Okay. So obviously one way is if you literally gathered up all the electrons and kept them here and then sent the ions off, I mean, that'd be one way to get them separated permanently.
But how far apart do they have to be?
Well, again, remember, if you try to separate a positive and negative charge, they don't like that much, do they? Right. See, so that's why, a plasma is one thing. It's a closed system sort of a phenomenon. It's another thing. What if you just have a stream, not of a plasma that's net neutral, but what if you just have a stream of positive particles going out from a star? Okay, that's a serious electric phenomenon. What if that bathed the non-breather world and caused disastrous electric disturbances? And right, there's a number of things in the Revelation where they talk, try to get you to appreciate. You can understand electric phenomena in space from a plasma perspective and how that could be problematic, but it has another dimension to it where you don't have a net neutral plasma in space. You just have these positive shattered atoms, positive charged shattered atoms heading out into space by themselves, not in the presence of electrons. Right. You see, the battle is just, that electron is not with them anymore, right. As they head out into space. That's all they mean by that. Okay. It's basically intact, except it's missing one of its electrons now, and it's nowhere to be found around it. It's missing electrons, not traveling with it. It's traveling alone, permanently broken, a derelict. Okay. All right, so now, let's see, anything else there? All these fierce encounters, they get stripped of an electron by all the X-ray activity. All right, so we've got the basics there laid out. Now they're going to start to play with it a little bit. Okay, something on the webinar, okay.
Yes, Chris, when science is so goofy in its hypothesis, and we think so prosaic, do you believe that better way might be to have an attitude of wonder and awe, to know that we can be both perspective, observation, and analytical about our science, philosophy, and religion? Yes, to be aloof and not definitive in our conclusions? Is that a possible better way?
Right, the better way is to have a true science. The only way you can have a true science is if you have a true religion. Just as the only way to have a true religion is to have a true science. Thinking you have a true religion when you don't have any scientific consciousness at all is delusional. You may know there's a God, but there's a big difference between knowing there's a God and having a true religion. And you know, is it surprising that if you steadily put any sense of God out of the picture, where you could possibly have organized space, for instance, right, that science would not be true anymore, even in the slightest degree? No. The farther you go from separating yourself from any attempt to keep it a holistic system, you know, the more false that that area of human endeavor becomes. Doesn't matter if it's politics or astronomy or whatever the heck it is. The farther it goes broken from being in a system, the more false it becomes. Yeah, and that's the pending issue on the planet, why this book is sitting in my lap. We need to put everything into a holistic system, right? Or you don't have truth anywhere. All right. Okay, so now see what they do is they go forward a little bit.
Calcium is, in fact, the chief element of the matter permeation of space throughout Overton. Our whole super universe is sprinkled with minutely pulverized stone. Stone is literally the basic building matter for the planets and spheres of space. The cosmic cloud, the great space blanket, consists for the most part of the modified atoms of calcium. The stone atom is one of the most prevalent and persistent of the elements. It not only endures solar ionization, splitting, but persists in an associative identity even after it has been battered by the destructive X-rays and shattered by the high solar temperatures. Calcium possesses an individuality and a longevity, excelling all of the more common forms of matter.
Okay, so here's where it begins to be hard to hold on to your current preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices that built up in getting your PhD in physics or astronomy. Okay, this is where you have to start, what on earth are they saying here? I thought this was the authoritative elimination of error. I'm not so sure now. Okay, it starts out right there in the first sentence. Calcium is, in fact, okay, just doubling down, okay, is in fact the chief element of the matter permeation of space throughout Orvintown. Okay, you're going, all right, now I'm certain this is just the ignorance of the early part of the 20th century. And all the person did is, I noticed instead of saying the calcium cloud, they said the cosmic cloud. So they just changed the word to try to fancy it up and gloss over their ignorance and make it seem like a revelation. Yeah, but it's obviously just, they're just talking about the calcium cloud thing. You know, as if there are calcium clouds. You know, we all know that the primary, the chief element of the interstellar medium is hydrogen. Everyone with any scientific, you know, education knows that it's not that calcium age notion. So this is obviously silly. Yeah. Matter of fact, calcium, you know, is way down the list. Let's start with hydrogen, and then let's bring in some helium, and how about some carbon and some nitrogen and some oxygen, and eventually down the list we'll get to calcium somewhere. Chief element? I think not. Okay, so what's going on here? Well, it starts with, as it often starts, with the words. Remember how I tell you all the time that if you don't know words at their deepest, most truthful level, you will misinterpret the revelation. You'll get yourself off on false tracks. You've got to appreciate. Did they say calcium is, in fact, the chief element of the matter of space throughout Orvintown? No, they did not. They said the matter permeation. Like, well, what's the difference? Well, what does the word permeate mean? Okay, does it mean just that it's spread out there everywhere? No, that's not what the word permeate means. Permeate means that it's flowing, not that it's just present. Okay, and the root of permeate, if you go all the way back to the Indo-European root there of that root part of the word, means wander. Right? The wanderer of space. Right. Yes, there's matter out there. Matter of fact, that whole issue, you know, we'll get to that in a while, is what they're saying between the lines. That whole issue of all that matter out there. Remember, you know, you don't have any idea about that right now. That the matter that's, a lot of that matter that's just present out there is forming out there. Starting with automatons and their curious huddling proclivity and building up into atoms and bigger atoms. And so, yeah, especially the smaller atoms like hydrogen, helium, yeah, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, like I was saying. Sure, yeah, there's all that stuff out there that's forming out there, all the way up to element 100. That's one thing, the stuff that's out there. But you remember, the basic point is that stuff forms out there and then collects into stars. And isn't out there. It goes into star prison. Right? That matter becomes imprisoned in stars. But there's escapees from prison. Okay? The primary, the chief element that is flowing out from the stars, escaping from prison, is calcium. Okay? Coincidentally, that very first element that you discovered out there, and an element that you should reflect on, how coincidentally it can escape from a star. The whole universe is sprinkled with minutely pulverized stone. Stone, what do they mean? Calcium. When you say calcium and stone, what pops into your head?
Bone.
A bone might pop into your head, but we usually don't think of bones as stone. But we'll get to bones in a second. Something called limestone, perhaps?
Limestone.
Right? Right? Limestone. Stone is literally the basic building matter for the planets and the spheres of space. Why do the planets and spheres of space exist? So just to exist? No. Why do material things exist? Why do material spheres exist? To be inhabited. Mm-hmm. Right? We very much appreciate the profound significance of calcium, not only in a universe of spheres, but in a universe of inhabited spheres. I mean, how do you make the shells of sea creatures with calcium? You know, it literally is calcium carbonate, like limestone. How do you make the bones in vertebrates with calcium? How do you make lime? Well, like quicklime. Would you like to have cement or mortar? Calcium would be handy for that. Would you like to build the pyramids? Blocks of limestone would be handy for that. Right. If you're going to have civilization with architecture that begins with stone and transitions from stone to concrete, you're not going to do it without calcium. Okay? All right. And then calcium is such a fundamental part of building life, right? And coincidentally, there's always going to be plenty of calcium that's not imprisoned, because coincidentally, it can escape from prison. Okay, whether or not uranium escapes from prison, okay, not as big a deal. But the very fundamental building block of life and in the worlds. I mean, not just, you know, for sedimentary rocks like limestone and such, but calcium is in, you know, all the igneous and metamorphic rocks too. I mean, calcium is one of, you know, one of the handful of elements. You know, it's a very important element. Okay, and they're trying to see, they're trying to get you to recognize that it's almost like there's a design here. Is there not? Coincidentally, that building block for where life is going to be and what life is hangs its, you know, hat upon is calcium. It's all built on calcium. It needs to be the wanderer's base. You know, there'll be enough of the other things that are out there, you know, especially the 19 elements that are lighter than calcium, that you're likely to be out there in big numbers just because it's all forming out there. And the smaller the atom, the more there is. But you need this really big atom. You need calcium, element 20. You need lots of it. And you know, if it's massive, it's all the more likely it's going to get bottled up down in the center of a star. And then what do you, you know, how do you have bones and seashells? If it's all bottled up in stars. Okay, that's why there's a whole section on calcium. And appreciating how from the earliest, you know, shades of civilization, it played the most critical role. There's no way to get civilization started without calcium. And there's no way there for it to be advanced life without calcium. Okay. All right. So yes, they did. If you know it, change the calcium cloud to the cosmic cloud. Okay. But with a genuine sense of the word cosmos, right, it means two things. Intensively, it means universal harmony. Extensively, which is more what we're talking about here, it means the harmonizing universe. Right? There's a harmonizing universe cloud. What if you say it, you know, spell it out? That's a little bit different than the calcium cloud. The harmonizing universe cloud. If there isn't that, if that harmonizing universe cloud doesn't have calcium in it, there can't be a harmonizing universe. Okay. That's what they're getting at here.
So calcium is really a bulky mineral because when you're taking like your supplements, you almost have to take six big capsules, you know.
Right. You need a lot.
It's huge.
You need a lot, and it's very heavy.
And the I just want to ask you about silicon too, because isn't that
silicon?
Silicon or silica? Yeah. Isn't that the primary too?
Right. So, I mean, you know, yeah. Obviously, you're not going to make silicate rocks. You're not going to make quartz. Without silicon and oxygen, right? I mean, they're very important too, but just, you know, you don't. I mean, appreciate how there's an issue with calcium that goes beyond like with silicon. You don't need silicon as universally as you need calcium. Calcium is this very universally needed thing everywhere from building pyramids, you know, to seashells, you know, to the bones in my inner ear.
Do they use calcium to build architectural worlds?
I see. Obviously, calcium, I'm sure, is a very fundamental, you know, element in architectural worlds. And, but I mean, just, you know, I obviously can't do full justice, but I know enough about calcium to know that this isn't just outdated gibberish. They're trying to remind me that the more you discover about calcium, the more you reflect upon it within the cosmic system, the more you'll understand why there's a whole section devoted to calcium, holding it up, but not silicon, not even carbon, which is a little hard to make organic molecules without carbon. Okay, it's pretty important too. But calcium is this bedrock fact upon which carbon and oxygen sit. See? It's like the Isle of Paradise, sort of, see, in the picture. It's the foundation upon which everything is built in a truthful sense. Don't think about it just simplistically, factually. It's like, well, there's a lot more than calcium in granite. Okay? Now think about the truth that flows through the spheres of space and the creatures on those spheres. And there's a foundational truth that is literalized via calcium. That's why there's a whole section on it. Right? And see, the fact finder, which you can't help but be if you've been trained in the 20th century to think, you're not a truth seeker, you're a fact finder. The fact finder is going to read this and just dismiss this as, you know, this is just at best outdated. Okay? And at worst, a deception. Okay, no. You gotta look at it. It's the revelation of truth, not the revelation of facts about calcium. They're not revealing facts about calcium. Purpose. The first purpose is to reveal truths about calcium. Did you know there's truths of calcium? No, they only handed me a fact sheet about calcium in class. They didn't hand me a truth sheet about calcium. Well, the book you're holding in your lap is a truth sheet about calcium. Okay, that's your job, is to figure out what is being revealed about the truth of calcium, not merely the facts of calcium. Once you have the truth, you can add some of the facts upon that truth foundation and improve your understanding of what's going on with those derelicts and that you're measuring the spectral lines of and stuff. Yeah. But truth first. Fact second. All right. So when they say the cosmic cloud, the great space blanket, consists for the most part of the modified atoms of calcium. See that cloud of foundational truth, right? You can't think about it in the fact finder mode where you go, no, it's mostly hydrogen. And this book is, you know, ridiculous. Okay, you're missing the point. You know? The hydrogen spread out there is not really a cosmic cloud. It doesn't represent the harmonizing universe. It represents the pre-harmonized universe. It's the raw material that hasn't been grabbed by anything yet and, you know, is sort of just there. But when you get, especially when you're talking about calcium, now you're talking about something where it's just dripping with purpose. Right? That's what they're getting at. It's a cosmic cloud, not just a cloud of gas. It's not just the interstellar medium, you know, that cloud of gas and dust. It's between the stars. What is it in truth? The truth begins with the calcium. The stone atom is one of the most prevalent and persistent of the elements. And notice what I say, it not only endures solar ionization, splitting. See, not only that, and see, they're defining, you know, ahead of paper 42, what they mean by ionization, just splitting, but not destroying one of the parts that have been split, not evaporating the electron, for instance, okay, just splitting the two apart, and they could get back together again. Okay. Yeah, that's ionization. That's step one, get it apart. But then, you know, what if that extreme environment, but the calcium atom persists as an associative identity. You take that apart and the whole atom doesn't unravel. You know, the rest of it is very integrous still. Even after it's been battered by the destructive X-rays, you know, like that destroyed the electron, and shattered, now it's shattered by the high solar temperatures. And this last line, calcium possesses an individuality, like you will when you leave Gerasim, where your integrous element in the cosmic system can't be diffused anymore, can't be unraveled anymore, right? A genuine individuality. It possesses an individuality and a longevity excelling all of the most common forms of matter. Now that, just briefly, to give you a sense of where that goes as you reflect upon that one and take that line of truth. As you begin to study the nature of the elements physically instead of just chemically, you will begin to quickly notice that calcium stands out. It's the biggest atom that stands basically unmoved in the midst of the current environment that our planet is immersed in. Elements higher start to drift off of center, as it were, in their nature. But calcium stands very definitive. And even, you know, there's not just one stable isotope of calcium, there's several. And even those ones that have drifted off center a little bit, I know I'm being a little vague here about what do you mean off center? Just, you know, there's sort of a center of symmetry, you know, and the environment is pushing it off that center a little bit. Even when it's pushed off the center a bit, it can be pushed off actually quite a bit. And it shows, it possesses an individuality, a longevity, excelling. It still stands unmoved. I mean, it either doesn't move at all, or if it does move a little bit, it still dominates over that. You've moved me, but I'm still just as rock solid as I was before. Who's the master here? I am. Me, the calcium atom. You know, my individuality still is master of this circumstance. And I need to be master of the environment because I'm fundamental. I'm a foundation element. If I don't stand unmoved, if I'm not sophistry proof, you know, to anthropomorphize it here, then all will fall. Okay? Humans without bones are not a pretty sight. Okay? You can't even have material sons and daughters without calcium. Right? Okay, so that's what they're trying to get at. And you can begin to see that as you begin to reflect upon how even our limited ignorant science of atoms, calcium strikes you as, you know, as having some sort of a resistance to influence. Okay. It's not like science hasn't noticed that a little bit. They call it a double magic nucleus, literally. So instead of invoking magic to explain that, maybe you should try to figure out literally objectively why it has that integrity. Why it would be purposed so integrous. And it's not magic that it's integrous like that. You know, I think I've mentioned that before many, many times ago. I mean, they literally use that term magic numbers when they're talking about this stuff.
Magic
numbers. Yes. Yeah, go ahead. There's something on the webinar.
Yes. So when we discover truth, can we understand it if we are not scientists? Is there any stress in discovering the truth, Chris? Could you comment, is our true view of truth is undisturbed if we don't know what we really have?
Well, we don't want to go too far afield, but just again, about when I talk about truth, just try to be present with what I'm saying first. Don't expect to understand exactly what it all means yet. It took me years before I think I began to feel any sense of exactly what truth meant. It's a very difficult thing to begin to feel some sense of, even in the face of having lots and lots of facts, you know, having a PhD in science. It isn't wholly dependent upon facts to get the process started. You need some factual grounding. You can't be just totally living in a figmentary, imaginary, you know, reality and expect to find truth, okay? But you don't have to have a deep, you know, appreciation of all the mechanics of it all to get started. Try to just be present with it and try not to prejudge things, you know, because you will unwittingly impose false assumptions that you've acquired from your environment that you don't appreciate that you're utilizing. You know, if you try to immediately start thinking about it, you know, try to feel your way. I mean, there's not a really word than that. You know, just try to, you know, sense your way with an inner sense, you know, an insight into it first. I mean, that's how, I mean, how do I slowly unravel a section like this? Initially, it seems like gibberish to me. Okay? And I just allow myself to be present with it long enough. And it's like, well, let me look up this and think about that, you know, and then I think about this. And, you know, you try to study what you can, it relates to various things they say, and then over time, your mind starts to have enough raw material that the influences that are, you know, exist in your mind begin to build form out of that raw material. And you'll eventually go, oh, wait a minute. You know, like you can have the idea, I don't know, maybe I should look it up. Maybe I should look up permeation. And you look it up and you go, ah, interesting. All right.
I feel sorry for the people who read the translations.
Right. It's very, very, right.
That's another topic.
Okay, so, all right, so I think enough said. Okay, you get the idea. That's the way you have to start with this. And you notice that, see those two paragraphs and then set off by a large paragraph break. Okay, you know, that's, you know, and it took us, you know, an hour and a half. Okay, now let's read, you know, the rest of it here, right, and just think a little bit about what they're adding to that basic picture. Okay, they're going to bring in a little bit of the facts. Okay.
As your physicists have suspected, these mutilated remnants of solar calcium literally ride the light beams for varied distances, and thus their widespread dissemination throughout space is tremendously facilitated. The sodium atom, under certain modifications, is also capable of light and energy locomotion. The calcium feat is all the more remarkable since this element has almost twice the mass of sodium. Local space permeation by calcium is due to the fact that it escapes from the solar photosphere in modified form by literally riding the outgoing sunbeams. Of all the solar elements, calcium, notwithstanding its comparative bulk, containing as it does 20 revolving electrons, is the most successful in escaping from the solar interior to the realms of space. This explains why there is a calcium layer, a gaseous stone surface on the sun 6,000 miles thick. And this, despite the fact that 19 lighter elements and numerous heavier ones are underneath.
Okay, two basic things there. We're going to get a little bit more in the whole bit about riding the light beam, quote unquote, coming up next. The one thing that they're doing, in addition to this distinction between ionization and shattering, is... They're trying. If you know how astronomers talk about this as opposed to physicists, they're trying to suggest a little more identification with a notation that the astronomers use. And when they talk, you notice how they threw in parenthetically. You know, they're talking about the calcium escaping, but they throw in the parenthetical in modified form. To stress that again. And you're going, oh yeah, I mean ionized? It's like, no, or shattered. but the interesting thing that astronomers were doing initially in labeling the spectra that they were observing, they have the notation where they take the symbol for the element, like calcium is capital C, small a, you know, Ca, calcium. And then after it, they put a Roman numeral 1, if it's neutral. If it's missing one of its electrons, then it's Roman numeral 2. If it's missing 2, it would be Roman numeral 3, etc. So they use that notation where, rather than saying, you know, calcium, you know, with a superscript of, you know, positive one, you know, literally like thinking of it like an ion, they refer to it as a modified form of calcium. Their notation actually is in that mode. And see, and the relators between the lines are suggesting that's actually kind of a handy thing that you guys did that. You know, you could actually use that distinction. You know, if you put a superscript to the, you know, plus one, plus two, or whatever on it, you know, okay, yeah, then you're really literally thinking of it as an ion. But if you think of it as a modified form, a shattered form, you know, not doing that and just putting, you know, this, you know, on the line with the CA, a Roman numeral 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or whatever, you know, like with iron, you know, it can be a very big Roman numeral because it may have had a lot of electrons stripped in the corona of the sun, say, okay, that's actually a way of really kind of thinking of it as a modified form of calcium rather than so much of an ion, even though technically, yeah, it's lost one of its electrons, okay? But it, you know, helps to remind you of how that calcium that's out there is very likely different than that oxygen atom that's out there. You know, there might actually be an ion in a plasma. Okay? Because how, you know, because the calcium ones and the sodium some can escape, but the oxygen ones are trapped in the prisons. Okay? You know, or they haven't gotten imprisoned yet and are out there and are in a plasma that's gotten ionized. A gas has gotten ionized into a plasma. All right, so that little tidbit in there, and then I mentioned that we'd be coming up, you know, that they were talking about the surface of a star, and it seemed like they were talking about it in a way that wasn't just the quote-unquote surface, the quasi-surface that we usually talk about, the photosphere, top of the photosphere. They seemed to be talking about something a little more literal. And remember, we talked before how you're thinking about there's sort of a sphere of tightly coupled motion, and then outside of that, there's the tenuous stuff that's more like an atmosphere above that surface, more like billiard balls above the surface of the tightly coupled region, okay, like the corona, for instance. And see, now they're making it even more definitive. Because these calciums are driven out of the interior of the star, they're telling you something that we don't, no, can't know. I mean, think about what they just told you. They told you there's a gaseous stone surface on the sun that's 6,000 miles thick, you know, a crust, quote unquote, that's 6,000 miles thick.
A gaseous crust,
of course. Right? But kind of crust-like, since it's made out of the foundational, you know, building block element, calcium. You know, that's something we can't know. That, you know, the deep down, you know, for, you know, I mean, that's 10,000 kilometers. There's calcium. Now, how this ties into, you know, the way a current scientist would dismiss this, again, someone is speaking about the calcium age again. Not only did they talk about calcium clouds, but the other fixation they had was they talk about the calcium chromosphere. The layer of the sun above the photosphere is called the chromosphere. And they first, you know, discovered calcium H and K lines in the chromosphere too. The chromosphere is part, if you see a total solar eclipse, you know, you can see the corona, like when it's totally eclipsed, you know, you have the beautiful corona all the way around it. But just as the moon begins to move off, or, you know, just as it moved on, there'll be a flash of pink, red light, very thin. That's the chromosphere. There's a very thin layer between the photosphere, well, relatively thin layer, between the photosphere and the corona. That's called the chromosphere. And they, you know, detected calcium in there, and they called it the calcium chromosphere. And now science say, well, you know, as if calcium is the most, numerous element there. It's hydrogen, obviously. And so here again is, you know, they're fixating on that, and then they're, you know, amping it up, you know, saying it's 6,000 miles thick, you know, prove me wrong, I'm a revelation. Right? I mean, but they're, and we'll get to this a little bit too as we go as we go into the next section next time. But see, they're pointing out that you have this this very thick layer that we have no idea is there. You know, that it has a high percentage of calcium in it. You know, and it's, you know, up through the photosphere and you know, like, say, halfway through the chromosphere above it. And at the top of that surface is really kind of at the top of where these calcium are sort of, you know, integrated in the system. You know, and then there's going to be some above that that have actually broken free and are beginning their grand adventure of wandering away. Okay? And you'll see some of those as emission lines superimposed upon the on the background because the temperature gets hotter above. You know, there's an actual temperature minimum that's the surface top, and then above that the temperature starts going up again, up hotter in the chromosphere and then really hot up into the corona. Okay, so that's what they're referring to there, and they're trying to get you to kind of start where you were back at the beginning of the 20th century with recognizing calcium there, but appreciating its it has a significance that you kind of ignorantly stumbled into way back then that you can't know, and we've just revealed it to you. You know, I mean, we don't have, you know, I mean, we can't even get anywhere near, you know, that many miles deep in any sort of a direct awareness. You know, we can't even get to the, you know, all the way to the bottom of the photosphere, let alone, you know, several thousand miles below the photosphere. Okay, so, yeah, so that's, again, a very important clue to understanding, to developing a stellar interior theory, is knowing that stars always have this layer of calcium, you know, that's sort of at the surface of this tightly coupled sphere. All right, let's see, anything else there? You notice that they reminded you again the local space permeation, you know, in contrast to the stuff that's just there, but the star part that's flowing through there, okay, in distinction. And the predominant, you know, element there is calcium. All right.
Well, if it's heavy, relatively heavy, mm-hmm. but it's up there on top
yep.
of this kind of an atmosphere of mm-hmm. gas.
Yeah.
What's keeping it up there? It has to be light pressure.
Yeah, that's what we're going to read next here. Oh, okay, okay. Right. Good question.
Calcium is an active and versatile element at solar temperatures. The stone atom has two agile and loosely attached electrons in the two outer electronic circuits, which are very close together. Each, early in the atomic struggle, it loses its outer electron, whereupon it engages in a masterful act of juggling the 19th electron back and forth between the 19th and 20th circuits of electronic revolution. By tossing this 19th electron back and forth between its own orbit and that of its lost companion more than 25,000 times a second, a mutilated stone atom is able partially to defy gravity and thus successfully to ride the emerging streams of light and energy, the sunbeams, to liberty and adventure. This calcium atom moves outward by alternate jerks of forward propulsion, grasping and letting go the sunbeam about 25,000 times each second. And this is why stone is the chief component of the worlds of space. Calcium is the most expert solar prison escaper.
You might notice they keep using the chief thing, you know, as opposed to some sort of technical thing. The largest mass fraction or the largest number fraction or something like this, some sort of a scientific, you know. But words like chief, like I said again, trying to get you, you know, it's in the truth of it. See, it's chief in truth. You know, don't think so factually. You know, so that it doesn't sound silly to be saying liberty and adventure. You know, like the adventure the calcium atoms are experiencing right now in your bones, in this curious life that you are living. That adventure, for instance. Participating in, you know, getting you to first to become a finaliter and then eventually an eternaliter. The calcium is helping you with that adventure. Okay, so two things. Let's start with the basic factual thing. Is something I should do first?
I think so. Could this have anything to do with the undiscovered energy we might someday figure out? Should we talk about that?
The answer is no.
Okay.
It's a fairly straightforward phenomenon. It doesn't involve any sort of like really mysterious issues. Now, remember what they said at the beginning of the previous paragraph. As your physicists have suspected. Okay, so this isn't deeply mysterious. Okay, but they're just stressing that any suspicion should be dropped. It's a fact. Okay, so what literally happens is. Okay, now think about the environment that this calcium atom, one of its electrons peeled off, is in down there in the interior of the star. There's a flux of energy that's moving outward. It's not totally isotropic, the same in every direction. It definitely has an outward favoritism. You know, otherwise we'd be freezing to death right now if the energy in the sun didn't have an outward favoritism, right? And so think about what's happening here. 25,000 times a second, you're getting that electron excited, and then it de-excites and gives off a photon. Okay? That as it emits that energy, it does so randomly, spherically symmetric. You know, so especially, just think about it over the course of 1 second. 25,000. So pretty much it's going to be going in every which direction spherically, symmetrically. So is it that photon leaves, the calcium will recoil. It's like it's firing a gun, right? And so the calcium atom recoils as it fires this projectile off. But if it does that 25,000 times a second, over this second that we're thinking about it, I mean, it's going to all average out. All the recoils are going to, net, it's not going to be moving anywhere because as many as are fired this way are fired in the opposite direction, and, it all cancels out. That outgoing momentum impulse on the calcium atom. But the incoming has got a bias. Over that second's time, that has a net momentum impartation is radially outward. See, so over the course of that second, it's going to net move. Yeah. So that's what they mean. Just think about it, average it over a second, and it's going to seem to just get a push, and then a push, and then a push, and then a push. But it's a net push, The sum of all of the momentum imparted, and and it gets excited, and then the momentum, that it feels, the recoil it feels when it, de-excites, the net phenomenon is jerk, 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 as it's slowly kicked out.
At the speed of light?
No. Okay. No. It's got mass. It's not going to move at the speed of light. it's going to move very slowly, inch by inch, it's going to creep its way, out this star. Okay, so that's, and so they're saying that idea is, is just what you can rationalize right now. And they're just making that definitive. And it's so definitive that it produces this 6,000-mile thick layer. All this calcium just gets pushed out of the center of the star. Okay. And then, of course, it's energetic enough that some of them get pushed out and head off wandering through space.
So it doesn't mean being pushed out, and what it says, it talks about riding?
Right. See, so it's riding it, but the question is, does it have enough, is there enough energy for it to ride all the way out? Or does it, obviously it's a balance. I mean, most of it doesn't get out. It's stuck there in that 6,000 miles thick layer, but some of it boils off, you know, off the surface. You know, just like, you know, so think of it like a, there's like a liquid surface of this calcium, and then some of them are going gaseous, you know, analogy-wise, you know, and boiling off the surface, escaping, evaporating, and heading off into space. You know, just use that simple thermal analogy to think about what's happening there.
By riding something.
Right. I mean, and they continue to ride. I mean, as they go past the Earth, they're still riding, you know, the light beams. Right? They absorb and re-emit.
The same beam or the same?
Well, no, I mean, just, you know, along comes a photon and excites it, and along comes another one and excites it, and along comes another one.
The same one.
Right, you can't, right? And for no other reason, the photon is moving at the speed of light, and the calcium atom is not. It can't keep up with it. Right.
But it should be going at a constant speed, right? I
mean, well, no, it's gonna, you know, it's a complex phenomenon. I mean, you know, it's moving out of the gravity well of the sun. I mean, you got to, you know, all those, you know, it's an outflow. And you can calculate all that stuff. I mean, just the same way we calculate the flow of the solar wind, you know, which is, you know, and that, you know, is basically the stuff that's boiling off the corona, you know, electrons and protons boiling off the corona and this solar wind blowing out. You can calculate all that, the velocities and the densities and all that sort of stuff.
Well, it's got to grab a lot of photons in it.
Right. Well, when, you know, it's got to grab 25,000 a second.
Yeah.
Okay, when it's down there in the star, it's grabbing 25,000 a second.
Forward, yeah, momentum,
yeah,
pulses.
Yeah, it absorbs that photon and then re-emits it. Yeah.
And in the emission,
yeah. And there's no favored direction in the emission, but there's a favored direction in the absorption, so it gets pushed out. Yeah. There's a net outward momentum push. Okay, now the other thing that they're throwing in there is a challenge to what you were talking about earlier. You know, right now, you know, when a current scientist thinks about how the H and K lines of calcium 2, you know, that has only 19 electrons, how they think about those H and K lines of calcium 2 are formed, you know, they understand that in the orbital model, where you don't literally have little particle electrons going around a nucleus, you know, you have distribution functions, you have clouds of probability, you know, in a quantum mechanical analysis of this thing. And there's quantum mechanical states that are, it's going between, you know, and all the energy works out and everything, you get the correct answers. But see, the way a current scientist would feel this sentence about, where it's the juggling the 19th electron back and forth between the 19th and the 20th circuits of electronic revolution. You're going, oh, good grief, that's like so, you know, early 20th century Bohr model of the atom. You know, no one thinks about the atom like that, like it was a little solar system anymore. I mean, that's you know, unless you're teaching grade school kids. But you know, once you're teaching more sophisticated students, you'd never talk about it so literally like that. And they're trying to remind you, okay, that there is still that literalness, and there's a structure of the actual orbits of the particles that we currently don't understand. We know lots and lots of detail about this smeared out influence, okay, and its geometry with spherical functions. But, you know, when they gave up the Bohr model, they gave up the particle. No one, see, so what they're talking about is something that needs to be figured out yet. Actually, what the 19th orbit is and what the 20th orbit is, science can't tell you that right now, because it doesn't literally think of little points in orbit. It talks about, you know, S orbitals and P orbitals and D orbitals, and, you know, it talks about, you know, these dumbbell distributions of potentiality and, you know, whatnot, these distribution functions. And see, so that is a little subtle thing where they're trying to challenge you again, just like saying, that X-ray stimulated electron. It's like, remember, we have, you've got literal particles. So it's forgetting that the photon is literally a particle. Here, it's forgetting that the electron is literally a particle and not just a smeared out thing, distribution. It's a point, it's effectively a point particle orbiting about a nucleus, on some path. Okay. And so that's a whole area of science that needs to be developed yet to make the atom objective rather than just mathematical. And I cannot tell you anything about the literalness of what they're speaking of there. I have a PhD in this. I had to pass tests on this sort of stuff. But there is no test on, describe the orbit of the 19th electron of calcium in contrast to the orbit of the 20th. There is no question in science like that. No one thinks about an atom that literally. Okay, and they think it's quaint to do that. Let's see, anything else there? Oh, yeah, the one other little thing. Remember how I was, seemed like I was kind of anthropomorphizing the calcium atom a bit? Who's the master? You notice they didn't say Master Lee. They said Master Full. So they mean like master, as in slave master, as who's dominant here and who's submissive. Who's the boss? Okay. It engages in a masterful act. It has to do a dance, but it does it as master, not slave to the sun. Okay, it's very important that they, so they're not just saying Master Lee, really clever what it's doing. No. See, they're stressing it. They want the more edgy word, okay, masterful. Okay. That it's not going to be beaten by this. Okay? It's broken but not beaten. Okay? So, you remember how we talked about how they talked about our starry associates. They called the things associates. So I'm making them sound like beings. See, they continue to do that. They're trying to remind you it's a cosmos. Okay? It's not just beings and, there's the things. I have to have something to stand on, but it's just, dirt.
Just like it says, calcium has an associative identity.
Right. To use that word association, right? It's a system. That same word that leads to society, for instance.
An identity.
It has identity because it's purpose. There's pattern imposed upon the actuality. And it has individuality. All these things. To begin to think about the matter as equal to you. Okay? The isle is not a slave to the eternal sun as master. They're equals in every way. Okay, especially in the eyes of the first source and center. They can't tell the difference between matter and spirit. Bound to be pretty equal in the eyes of the Father. Okay? Can you begin to see yourself in a cosmic system, not just in with the way the current scientists use the word universe, as a being in a collection of gas and dust. Okay? No, can you see yourself in a cosmic system where there's just as much purposing to a calcium atom in eternity as there is purposing of you in eternity? Just as much. No difference. Okay, in quality or quantity.
Wouldn't something indicative of body and will be, if you fuse with your adjuster, the body is consumed. So there's an identification there between matter and spirit via mind that actually consumes as if it's bonded.
Right, I mean, again, you don't, you know, when you fuse you adjust, you have a substance to hang your soul on now. You don't need that material scaffolding. But of course, you know, that's just a temporary thing. They got to build Marantia scaffolding under
right,
you.
But,
you know,
I mean,
but
I mean, like, why would it fuse? I mean, you could just drop the body on the ground and then just not do
it. Well, again, the reason that the body, you know, disappears is because it's an extremely high energy event. Remember, it's not just a fragment of pure spirit, it's also pure energy.
I mean,
you're bringing, you know, the molecular structure of your body into direct juxtaposition with the energy nature, not the spirit nature, the energy nature of the adjuster, and it unravels it into automatons.
Well, it's power, personality, synthesis.
Right, but so you got it, but not all power can be simply bonded to spirit. See, you know, there's power in your soul that doesn't unravel. Okay, you know, the body disappears, you know, is unraveled into automatons, but the soul isn't unraveled into automatons. Okay, that physical energy in the soul structure, that, you know, the woof part of the warp and the woof of the soul, I mean, that can withstand being in direct contact with the energy of the adjuster.
Right,
but this couch can't.
Right, the body's on a gross level, though, and it's pretty easy to go up in.
Right, it's a very delicate, low-level structure.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Now, it's, you know, it has limited integrity as a molecular structure. It has limited integrity as an atomic structure. It has a very definitive integrity as an automatonic structure, and the adjuster can't unravel automatons.
Especially when spirit, yeah, then you're talking about a whole different scenario, which...
Yeah, it's just, yeah, I mean, you get the sense of, you know, that's, you know, remember there's just two substances, and so you have that, you know, you're slowly transferring from a material identity to a spirit identity when you leave the local universe, and so you just have that transition of eventually hanging all of yourself within spirit substance, you know, as that spirit fragment. Okay, back to calcium here. Okay, so you notice what they say at the end there, and this is why stone is the chief component of the worlds of space. Calcium is the most expert solar prison escaper. Yeah. I knew that was coming. That's why I've been talking about it like that. Right, see, and that helps you to get this clear in your head about what we're talking about. We're not talking about things that haven't been imprisoned yet. The profound phenomenon is not that stuff that hasn't been incorporated into stars yet. The profound phenomenon is the stuff that escaped being incorporated into a star. Which in general is a pretty tight grasp. It's a lot of mass. There's a lot of gravitational traction there. Not to mention all of this integrity of that sphere and having to be liberated from being, you know, dynamically bound in it. Okay. So that's why, again, this is stress. They keep trying to help you by saying things like that to get out of the mode. I don't understand why there's this whole section on calcium. Why isn't there one on hydrogen? Hydrogen is the most prevalent element, you know, in the universe. I mean, why? What's about calcium? Okay. All right.
The agility of this acrobatic calcium electron is indicated by the fact that when tossed by the temperature X-ray solar forces to the circle of the higher orbit, it only remains in that orbit for about 1/1,000,000th of a second. But before the electric gravity power of the atomic nucleus pulls it back into its old orbit, it is able to complete 1,000,000 revolutions about the atomic center.
Okay, so some things are, I mean, you know, appreciating that lasts about 1/1,000,000th of a second, that's right in line with the kind of things we, you know, we understand. But we don't think about it again in this literal fashion where you have this, you know, this particle. You know, we think about it as this transition of quantum states, okay? But to think about literally with a particle, you know, so that you're thinking about revolutions. So, you know, if it's there for about a millionth of a second, and it completes a million revolutions during that time, how many revolutions per second?
A million times a
million. Right. A trillion times a second that electron goes around the nucleus. Okay. A trillion times every second. So is it going to seem like Pluto lollygagging around the sun? Is it even going to seem like Mercury skipping around the sun? No, I mean, it's going so fast. Point to it. Well, it's kind of like everywhere. You see, again, just its very, you know, the speed of it, see, feeds into this blurring it out. Okay? But, you know, then you have also, it's not, you know, they don't think of it as just being blurred out along a line. You know, they think of it as blurred out over a sphere. That's a different issue. Okay? But just, you know, appreciate that. That's why they're giving you that, to remind you of, yeah, and that's, you know, right in the ballpark of what you'd kind of calculate if you played around with a Bohr atom picture. You know, somewhere in the ballpark of trillions.
Well, let me see if I've got the right picture. When it said two orbits, I made the assumption these are two at the same level. But these are...
Well, I mean, who knows what to... What am I supposed to assume, see?
Well, what I'm hearing here is that, yeah, most of the time it's in one orbit.
Right.
But once every 25th of a second, it jumps up for a millionth of a second to the higher orbit.
Right.
And falls back down.
Right, I mean, see, so the initial way to think about it is in a Bohr model sort of a sense, that you've got an outer orbit and an inner orbit, and it's going between them, like between Mars and Earth, you know? Okay. But again, you know, that's, you know, how analogy to the solar system, you know, I mean, like I said, no one has developed this physics. Exactly what do these orbits literally look like? Okay. That's unexplored physics territory. Okay, so just, now, the other thing about it being literally a particle, they throw in the mysterious thing, it's not just electric, you know, and right now they'll think about these transitions in electric ways. Gravity, you know, they'll go, okay, so obviously whoever wrote this doesn't know anything about physics. I mean, the gravity doesn't have anything to do with atoms, you know, being held together. No, it's, you know, you need to understand the phenomenon of gravity more. It's a lot more complex than you think. And they'll get into that some in paper 42. But just think about how the very fact that you're thinking about it as a particle, is it not logical that there would be something that would be appropriately called gravity that would be the, you know, describing why it's in orbit and how it's in orbit? I mean, why is the Earth in orbit around the sun? Because of the gravitational, you know, attraction. You know, that's how we understand that phenomenon. You see, so just again, that fact that the word gravity comes in is because the word particle now is being put into the picture. I mean, obviously, a spherical cloud of influence doesn't need to be orbiting in any gravity sense or anything. It's just this magical thing that is just there. Why? Because. Right. Right. Okay. But so that they're throwing in that little bit, you know, just again to stress the literalness, and help you a little bit with some factual reference points. You know, trillion times a second. That's a data point you could hang your hat on. You know, if your theory doesn't get a trillion times a second, then you need to, you know, work on a better theory. Right.
Your sun has parted with an enormous quantity of its calcium, having lost tremendous amounts during the times of its convulsive eruptions in connection with the formation of the solar system. Much of the solar calcium is now in the outer crust of the sun.
Right, so it's been pushed out now, like they're saying. It's been a long time. And then think about this. You had that a lot of it, you know, out there in the outer part. So you get that big tongue of matter pulled off by the Angana system when it goes by. It's going to have a lot of calcium in it because it was pulling off a big glob of surface material. So that, you know, that we didn't have to have all of the calcium that's in my bones escape from prison, you know. Some of it got ripped out of prison by a prison break as the Angana system went by, okay? Little help there. Kind of like secondary midwares doing prison breaks, okay? And the Angana system did that too. All right.
It should be remembered that spectral analysis show only sun surface compositions. For example, solar spectra and exhibit many iron lines. But iron is not the chief element in the sun. This phenomenon is almost wholly due to the present temperature of the sun's surface, a little less than 6,000 degrees, this temperature being very favorable to the registry of the iron spectrum.
Okay, I mean, you know, we kind of appreciate that. You know, you heard me mention iron, there's lots and lots of iron lines, and, you know, we appreciate that stars at this temperature have lots of iron lines. But they're doing that again to just to remind you, because there still is a strong tendency to forget about how you've never actually looked at what's down inside the star, and that you're making lots of assumptions. That's often forgotten, and what's in the inside of a star is spoken of just as factually as what we observe on the outside. So they're reminding you of that again. And now that last little comment transitions to what we'll talk about next time. A very interesting statement of saying, and that's 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, not Kelvin. It's not the approximate effective temperature in Kelvins. That's 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is way colder than you would expect. But notice how it's in the context of talking about the sun's surface again. Not the photosphere, not its effective temperature, you know, but something to do more literally with its surface. And we'll get into that, you know, as we get into the next section. So, you know, that's, you know, there's a twofold purpose to that last paragraph, to segue you into the next section, you know, and say that very, huh? thing, you know, and it's not a hut until you get a little bit further and they tell you all the temperatures are in Fahrenheit. When you first read it and you're a scientist and you're thinking it's Kelvin, you know, okay, yeah, okay, we know that. Okay, and then later when they tell you it's Fahrenheit, it's like, whoa, wait a minute. Okay, you know, and they're still trying to figure out, you know, what some of these mysterious lines are. It's like, well, I think this is probably an iron line, but yeah. You know, like I was telling you, some of these, like especially the forbidden transitions, you know, they're still trying to pin down all those because there's just zillions and zillions of spectral lines, you know, in the spectrum and try to figure out what every one of them is. It's very difficult, you know, especially when you're dealing with iron that could be, it have many, many, many electrons stripped off. You've got just, you know, every time you have a modified form, you have a whole collection of different spectral lines for that one than you do for, you know, another modified form. So it's very complicated. You know, and if you talk about iron, that's, you know, iron 11 or something, you know, right? You know, so it's very complex. All right. All right. I hope that helped a little bit with a long-standing mystery of this calcium section. And you notice it all really hinged upon never forgetting that the purpose of the revelation is to reveal truth, not facts. Don't start with, look, you know, what facts are they trying to tell me? You're never going to get on the right track. You're just confused. Try to figure out the truth first and then work on the facts. That's a universal to the entire revelation. If you do it any other way, doesn't matter if you're talking about God the Father or calcium. If you try to do facts first instead of truth first, all you're going to get is preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and long-standing prejudices. You're just going to put new wine in old wineskins. You're not going to get any revelation. You're not going to get something new. And you're pretty sure, the more you think about it, that the book is totally erroneous. Right? You'll enter it with the hopes of being a truth seeker, and you'll end up being an error finder and disillusioned. And you'll put the book down and go somewhere else. I don't want that to happen to you. You don't have to look elsewhere because this is outmoded science or something. There's nothing outmoded. It's transcendent in truth of everything that anyone is thinking right now. And never forget that. Hold on to that until finally you can coordinate the facts properly. All right, let's take a moment here.